Our bodies contain multitudes, sitting here at the intersection of so many different identities, some of which have been historically overlooked. Sammy Schalk is an associate professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's the author of Black Disability Politics, A History of Disability Rights and Black Activism. She says understanding Black disability politics is essential to building an accessible future for everybody. Here's producer Shannon Henry Kleiber.
I wanted to first ask, Sammy, how do you define Black disability politics?
So first, disability politics is the approach to disability as a political and social issue rather than as simply a personal or a medical issue, which is often the way that it's thought about, that it's something that's in your body, in your mind, between you and your doctor, between you and your family, right? But disability politics says, no, this is something that is shaped by our understandings of culture and society and politics. So then Black disability politics is specifically the way that Black communities, Black activists, and Black organizers have approached disability as a political issue.
Is one of the reasons that's so important is to not feel like we're alone in whatever's going on with us individually?
I think not feeling alone, but also learning from the different ways that folks have done this work. I think that the work of the Black Panther Party that I talk about and the National Black Women's Health Project, I think that work is really important and useful for us in disability justice movements right now. So if we're only looking at our history as being that work that was done by the mainstream, predominantly white disability rights movement, we might not be able to pick up on certain approaches and understandings of disability that are going to be really useful to us now. I think especially as in the wake of the pandemic, more and more people are disabled, more folks of color are disabled, right? So we're in this moment of, I've been calling in my kind of conversation since the book came out, that the pandemic is a mass disabling event. Yeah. And so we have all these newly disabled people. And I think that the approaches from Black disability politics and the work of other disabled people of color, disabled queer and trans folks is going to be really useful as we bring folks into community and into movement work.
What's the connection between Black civil rights and disability rights? You bring this up in your book that they're connected.
Yeah, well, I think they're connected in large part because the systems of oppression are connected. I believe that ableism functions to support racism. It functions in the place of racism, that racism operates depending upon ideas of ableism. The idea behind ableism is that disabled people, people with body minds that are different from the norm, should be treated differently, cured, should be medicalized, put away, like institutionalized. And that then becomes justification for also treating Black folks differently, because Blackness historically has been designated inside of these categories of mental and physical difference, right? So the belief that Black folks were mentally inferior to white people as a justification for slavery, moving outside of race, the way that homosexuality was in the DSM as a psychological disability until the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So these other systems rely on ableism to function. And so my argument is that if we're going to try to dismantle white supremacy, we also have to dismantle ableism. We have to incorporate disability into our analysis and into our approach because these systems work together. They function together and support one another.
So I think our listeners know a little bit about what ableism is, but I'd like you to explain it more. What is ableism? And can you give some examples of how someone might experience it?
Yeah. The basic form of a definition of ableism is discrimination against disabled people and preference for able-bodiedness. But the way this manifests in our society isn't necessarily just about directly people with disabilities. It's also about a perception of what is an appropriate norm, an appropriate way to be in the world. So we see, for example, the ways that we determine what is the amount of time, I'm thinking here about my students on campus, what's the appropriate amount of time between classes that someone needs to transition to move from here to here? That's the creation of an able-bodied norm that says 15 minutes is all you need to get from here to here. And if you can't do that, then you're disabled. So we're constantly setting these norms and these expectations. Again, in the wake of the pandemic, I think a lot of us realize how much better we can work from home, when we're able to be in spaces that make our bodies comfortable, we have access to the food we need, we can really have more control of our environment. And so some of us, that move, that push to go back to work makes us realize how much that environment can be disabling to us, can be very difficult for us. So ableism is the belief that all of us should meet this norm, and that if we don't meet this norm, there's something wrong with us. And those norms are physical norms, mental norms, ideas of the ability to reproduce, to work, excellence, intelligence, all of these things are norms that we have created within our culture about body minds.
Yeah. You start your book with a 1977 description of the Black Panthers. Can you describe this picture that was on the cover of the newspaper, and what is the story behind that?
Yeah. So in April 1977, there was a protest of the Health, Education, and Welfare Department, HUE, H-E-W, by disabled people in order to try to get Section 504 of the 1970 Rehabilitation Act passed. So there was this section that had been written into law, and the law had technically passed, but they had not written regulations on what that meant. The section essentially said you cannot discriminate against disabled people in anything that receives federal funding, right? So that's some of our public schools, hospitals, things like that. But because the government had not yet defined what constitutes discrimination or who counts as a disabled person, there was nothing that you could do to kind of implement the law at that point. And so disabled people had organized to have these protests. And the longest lasting protest happened in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, where there has been a long history of disability organizing in that space. And that also happens to be where the Black Panthers in Oakland were based. And they had a Panther who had been doing this kind of cross-bridging work, Brad Lomax. Brad Lomax was a Black Panther who had multiple sclerosis. So after he became a Black Panther, he became increasingly disabled, started using a wheelchair. And so he was invested in ensuring that the Black Panthers' spaces, so their community center and their schools, their clinics, were accessible for disabled people. And to do that work, he started partnering with other disabled people and activists in the Bay Area. So he became that bridge link as a disabled Black Panther. And that's often how these kind of connections happen, right? As someone who operates inside of both communities starts to make those connections. So they brought food every single day to this protest. There's no way that people could have occupied this building for as long as they did without that regular support of food coming in from the Panthers.
What was the result of the protest? What happened?
Section 504 was passed. Yeah. So it became our
first. It worked.
Yes, yeah. It absolutely worked. They stayed for, again, over 20 days inside the building, sleeping and staying in. They sent some delegates to DC to talk to representatives. And eventually, yes, the Section 504 was passed and it became our first really expansive anti-discrimination act for folks with disabilities that eventually the Americans with Disabilities Act, which we now know as kind of the main Protection Act for folks with disabilities. It was passed in 1990. It really builds on the work of Section 504.
I'm thinking a lot about, as I'm reading your book, language and how language has changed throughout history of how we try to do no harm in describing what's going on with people's lives and how we just describe each other and ourselves. How, as a scholar and as a researcher and a person experiencing this, how has language changed and what are some of the terms and the language you think people should be using today?
So one, disability is the chosen term within the community at this time. I think there are a lot of folks who are resistant to that term, who want to look at the etymology and the definition to be like, well, it means not able, and want to resist that by using these other kind of what we call faux nice terms sometimes of handicapable or specially abled, special, all these terms that try to make it seem nice, but don't actually really do anything functionally in the world other than obscure connections to one another as disabled people. Sometimes it takes folks a while to get to the term disability, and there are lots of historical reasons for that and individual reasons for that. But I think collectively using this term can be really important to find community and to connect to one another.
Can you talk about why someone might not want to describe themselves as being disabled? And I think you talk about that personally a little bit. Can you tell your own story?
Yeah. So I think for a lot of us, disability is so strongly associated with official medical diagnoses and labels, with accommodations in the workplace or in school, or with receiving state support. And so we feel like, well, if we don't rise to that threshold that the state has determined equals disabled, that we can't use that language. But also there's so much stigma associated with disability, which is why the disability justice and disability rights movement exists, is to really resist that stigma and say that having a disability is just another way of moving through the world that isn't necessarily good or bad. It just is. And sometimes it may include things that are difficult, and other times it may include different ways of moving through the world that make things easier or better. And if we have a non-apparent disability, something that isn't necessarily visible on our bodies or in the way that we behave all the time, there's this desire to protect ourselves from the oppression that we might experience. And that's really what I think was happening for me. I was already Black and queer and a woman, and I was like, man, adding another thing, it just seems like a lot of things. But what I found through being in disability community, through the disability studies, it really made me realize that I was learning so much about how to navigate the world in ways that was so much better for my body and my mind. I learned so much through being in disability community that it allowed me to start to think about, okay, what if I claim this word for myself and what would that mean? How do we use this language? Do we insist that people use this language? This has been a part of disability rights for a long time, really insisting people use the word disability and claim the word disability. And the Black disabled activists that I talked to were so thoughtful about saying, yeah, this is a thing that we would like people to do. Not because we want to check off more boxes and be able to claim there's this many disabled people in the country, but because disability identity is a tool to come into community. And when you come into community, you're able to start to realize, oh, these things I'm experiencing are not just me. I'm not just alone. And it has led to me finding and connecting with so many other people who have similar disabilities as mine and being able to, yeah, learn so much more about how to navigate the world. From as simple as, you know, someone telling me, did you know that there are cordless heating pads? And I was like, I did not know there are cordless heating pads. I need to get that. So now I can have a cordless heating pad and move around sometimes in order to still go about my day while having back pain like I do.
I also wanted to talk about joy. So you are a pleasure activist.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? What is a pleasure activist?
Yeah, the concept of pleasure activism for me comes from the work of Adrienne Marie Brown. She has a book called Pleasure Activism, so I encourage folks to check that out. I have an interview essay inside of that book. At the core is the belief that pleasure is political. And pleasure is political because who gets access to pleasure? Whose pleasure is encouraged versus policed, criminalized, shamed, right? Those things are shaped by our political norms. It's shaped by our cultural norms. And so there are some of us that our pleasures are considered good and positive, and others who it's not. Those of us who are most free in this culture have the most access to pleasure, to leisure. So pleasure here is not just sexual pleasure. It's much broader. It's this concept of being able to have satisfying experiences, deeply satisfying experiences. So pleasure activism then takes this idea that pleasure is political and says, how do we incorporate that into our movement work? How do we encourage people to embrace pleasure, to experience pleasure, to make space for other people's pleasure? And that is actually how we make liberation work long-term sustainable. A lot of the pleasure activist work, I think, is coming out of organizers seeing other organizers burn out, become exhausted, and have to stop doing movement work altogether because they were unable to make space for joy and for self-care inside of the work.
So what are some of your pleasure experiences these days? I know that there's a Janelle Monáe experience. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so I, on Sunday, was able to get on stage and twerk with Janelle Monáe, which was a magical, magical experience. And with Janelle Monáe's new album, The Age of Pleasure, for me, it's 100% a pleasure activist album. And I booked a ticket to the Indianapolis show because it was one of the shows that had seating, and went with my partner and tagged Janelle Monáe and Wonderland many, many times to see if they would allow me to come on stage. And yeah, they sure did. So I got to go on and I held Janelle Monáe's hand.
Oh, wow.
They said my name. We danced, we hugged. It was pure magic, pure magic, pure joy, pure pleasure.
It's wonderful. Wow. It's so great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Sammy Schalk is the author of Black Disability Politics, which is now an open access book that's free to download. There's a link on our website at ttbook.org. And that was Shannon Henry Kleiber talking with her.